technologies have the potential to create rather extreme exploitation and, as a result, suffering. Coming back one more time to the Luddites you mentioned earlier, of course, they were very upset about being herded into factories, and basically their life was being controlled by machines. And there's another aspect to this here, because control, often technological control, is often also needed for exploitation, i.e. you first have to get the workers into the factory to be controlled by the machine schedule in order for them to be exploited as well. So, and I think that's why the Luddites were so upset about it, and they started smashing the machines, because they saw the machines as instruments of both control and exploitation, because these Luddites were just living out in the countryside, working at home, spinning their yarns or whatever they did, with family members around. Their pace of work was not controlled by anything, just by themselves, and then suddenly they were told to tend machines according to a certain schedule. And so I think that is understandable that they were rather upset about it, being yanked out of their workshops and homes into, you know, stinking factories somewhere to do the work for others.
Is it possible at this point in our culture and our development to step back from technology and to avoid a collapse? And do you think that we could revert back to like a hunter-gatherer lifestyle of our ancestors?
A hunter-gatherer lifestyle would not be possible for the current world population of about 7 billion. Prior to the agricultural revolution, about 10,000 years ago, there were only 10 million humans. And those 10 million humans were most likely hunter-gatherers, and that was most likely the maximum number that the Earth could support, you know, 10 million hunter and gatherers. That lifestyle, the carrying capacity of that lifestyle was probably close to 10 million. Although I do not have hard data on that, but I suspect that this was the maximum carrying capacity. Now, with the invention of agriculture, the carrying capacity of the land was increased at least tenfold. There were 100 million humans around 2,000 years ago, so the carrying capacity increased tenfold. And then with the Industrial Revolution, the carrying capacity of the land was increased again tenfold. So we can see here that with each wave of technological innovation, first the Agricultural Revolution and then the Industrial Revolution, the human population has expanded rapidly. Therefore, if we were to revert back to a more primitive lifestyle that is not supported by advanced technologies, the carrying capacity would shrink dramatically and billions of humans would not be able to survive.
I wanted to ask if you thought that it's possible to avoid a collapse at this point, because we have so much technological complexity and all that complexity seems beyond anybody's control. Is the only eventuality for the whole system just to fall apart?
All three preconditions for collapse are present in technological societies. First, we have rapid growth in resource use and pollution. There's still economic growth. There's still, because of this economic growth, we have more need for resources and we will have more pollution. Second, resources are limited, and ecosystems can only absorb that much waste. There's a limited waste absorption capacity. That's why we have global warming. There's not enough capacity to absorb the CO2 we are generating. And then the third precondition for collapse that is currently also there is delayed responses by decision makers. These politicians are not acting fast enough to turn things around towards a sustainable solution, towards a sustainable society. And I believe it was David Suzuki, I'm paraphrasing him here because I don't remember the exact statement, who gave a great analogy of our situation. He said something like, society is like a car racing at top speed toward a cliff with politicians at the steering wheel and the rest of us locked into the trunk. And I think that's what the situation seems to be right now. And I personally believe that without a significant change in society's values, the current direction of progress in science and technology will only implement the existing values of growth, exploitation, and inequality, and thereby accelerating us towards collapse.
What if everyone just said, okay, no more iPhone 6s, no more you know, iPads, no more TVs. I'm fine with a 5-year jubilee of technology development. Let's just keep technology static. Would the economy fall apart instantly? What would happen to the economy?
According to factor analysis in neoclassical growth theory, technological innovation is the main driver behind economic growth, particularly behind per capita economic growth, which means per capita material affluence. So you are correct. If technology would be static, we would have less economic growth and we would have less corporate profits. But I don't agree with you that the economy will fall apart, because people still would produce all the stuff that is important to them, food, clothing, shelter, etc. The end result might be more something like a static, no growth economy, which I called earlier a steady state economy. So that's actually not that bad to have a steady state economy, because a transition to a steady state economy is necessary to ensure long-term sustainability. I personally actually do not believe in stopping all technological development. I think we should be selective. We should stop only the technologies that are bad, if you want to call it that way, that are bad for the environment and actually bad for people, for people's happiness and psychological well-being. And we should put much more energy and emphasis into the development of technologies that help the environment, improve the environment, clean up the environment, and also in technologies that are, I call them socially appropriate, technologies that are good for people, that people feel comfortable with, that help people to improve their well-being, their happiness, their interaction, their communities, etc. So, in summary, we should be selective in terms of what technologies we should develop and should not develop.
Well, couldn't you argue that any technology that is making people happy is improving their lives? Like, you know, television is making me happy, so is it not improving my life?
You bring up television. Actually, they did studies on television, and television does not make people more happy. People who watch television get into some kind of hypnotic state. I think it was beta waves. I'm not quite sure. So they are not necessarily more happy. Also, I mentioned earlier that television, as an example again, embodies the values of individualism, because you individually interact with the television screen, for instance. And it is well known from the psychological literature that individualism is negatively correlated to happiness, and that interacting with other people, like in marriage, friends, family, friends, etc., communities, that interaction with other people is a main source of happiness. So if you watch television, you're not interacting with other people, thereby getting deprived of sources of happiness. And this kind of thinking actually applies to many other technologies, because technologies are mostly biased towards individualism and materialism, and both individualism and materialism, there's a large psychological literature, they found it's negatively correlated to happiness. So this brings me back to this whole problem of advertising. I think we are just told by the media and by the millions of ads we see throughout our lives that all these technological products and gizmos and gadgets will make us happy, but actually the scientific literature shows they don't make us more happy. So we are just duped.
That closes out our interview with Michael and our episode of The Extra Environmentalist for this week, February the 29th, here on CITR 101.9 FM.
If you would like to listen to more of The Extra Environmentalist, you can always check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can leave us a voicemail message. You can find us on Skype, where you can also leave us a voicemail message.
And that's about it. So from Seth and Justin at The Extra Environmentalist, we'll look forward to catching you on next week's episode.
Thank you to The Extra Environmentalist. This is CITR 101.9 FM. Right now we're going to head into our final piece, special broadcast piece dedicated to Black History Month right here at the station. Coming up next, you have an interview with Randy Reed, who is the program manager at CHRY. That's New York University in Toronto. This was done by Daniela. And following that, we have one with Brother Kofi Sankofa, who is an activist and educator and a poet out of Toronto as well. So stay tuned. Hope you enjoy both of these interviews. Thank you for tuning in.
Oh, will I be my sin? I ask them see. I know they still have some evil purpose in mind. What of me? Oh, yes. I'm not sure if I really get to see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrows. Bodies like gold as gunmen strike bold. And the wicked people work is taking off like an arrow. I wonder if I will see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrow. Bodies like gold as gunmen strike bold. And wicked people work is taking off. I'm not afraid to die, but afraid to live until death. It's not hard for you to guess what will happen next. Heartaches and pain, work upon godliness. Some don't know why them a live, that's why them have to hurt the flesh. But who are they? Tell me. What I represent, I struggle with fear as I experience. So them do them dirty work, to which I resent. And no one but them are gonna face the consequence. They build walls instead of bridges, it's ridicule. Then war with whom they live, like a fool. But if I drive the wrong road, away I want to pull. Because the vessel of the iniquity never yet full. I wonder if I will see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrows. Bodies lay cold and gunmen strike bold. And wicked people work is taking off like an arrow. I wonder if I will see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrows. Bodies lay cold and gunmen strike bold. And wicked people work is taking off. Oh yes, that burning concern is no longer there. They're filled with the medicine where Babylon prepare. Instruments of cruelty, presence everywhere. Strong enough to take a life, but not enough to care. As the road gets dark, I expect anything. I know not many miss, so it leaves wondering. Many life was lost, who is the next victim? It could be you, it could be I, to all them set the system. Them kill without a cause, what is the meaning? So no one knows what tomorrow may bring. I'm not sure if I will live to see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrows. What is like gold as gunmen strike bold. And the wicked people work is taking off like an arrow. I wonder if I will see tomorrow. Living in this world of conflicts and sorrows. What is like gold as gunmen strike bold.
We're talking with Randy, Program Manager at CHRY 105.5 in Toronto, based out of York University's campus. And today we are going to be discussing some questions in regards to Black people, Black culture, Black community. And I guess the purpose, I tried to figure out a purpose. I think just to get perspectives, really. In general, just perspectives, like, on where Black people are today.
Big question.
This is a big question. But we'll just use these ones. And then hopefully we can form some sort of general idea or answer. So, does Black History Month have any special meaning to you? Why or why not?
I've always felt like it had a special meaning for me. Just growing up, as a Black male, I've always thought it important to find role models. And that's it's been a big part of my life growing up in a single parent household, looking for role models. Black History Month always represented an opportunity for me to identify new role models in history, if not, you know, locally to where I was coming from. So I always appreciated the month for that aspect and took advantage of it for all the resources and information that it sent my way.
Nice. That's a very interesting perspective. I don't think I've ever heard anything like that. That's great. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe the work that you've done with your community, I guess in Toronto, right?
For sure. I guess tailing off of Black History Month again, growing up in a single parent household, I've always, you know, look for mentors growing up to see, you know, how not to make the same mistakes as sort of the predecessors before me type of thing. And I got engaged in mentoring at a young age. So I was involved in sports at a high level, both in track and field and more so in basketball. And I took those opportunities to mentor. I've always been in a mentorship role since I was the age of 14. Mentoring my peers and mentoring younger people. So developing that, I guess that element in terms of how I carried myself and how I conducted my day-to-day work. It led me to opportunities where, you know, I was running camps of 250 plus at the age of, I was directing those camps at the age of 18.
That's amazing.
Right? And yeah. So it gave me opportunities to, mentoring always was, I held that in a special place. I always think it's important to, if you're practiced and if you're thoughtful about the things that you do, that it's important to share that with other people, because I always felt that was a kind of a void that I had in my life.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So I guess in saying that then, as a Black male, you do feel that you have a role to play in your community, and I guess as an example, as a mentor then?
Yeah, I've mentored, I've coached basketball. Mm-hmm. I've coached basketball at the provincial level. So I coached the Ontario JDP team and junior development program.
That's amazing.
Yeah, okay. So we went to nationals. We traveled to Turkey. We traveled to Paris. We traveled to Brazil and all across Canada with those kids. And I've coached, you know, two OFSA championship teams. And so even just on the coaching level, I've always been surrounded by a dozen to 15 or more young people every six month period through rep ball and through regular basketball. And that would be something I do on the side from my own work, just working in community developments for, like 15 years now. So, you know, working at Boys and Girls Clubs of Canada as a consultant, you know, we've developed programs that, you know, and it really based on my life mantra, which is to give people opportunities.
Okay. So, yeah, that's great. And so is it more of an emphasis in Black communities, or because you are considered, like, as a Black man, you want to do this? Do you want to be this example? Or it's, you think, I don't know, it's hard to...
Yeah, I think you hit it on the head right there. Like, I do it as a... You can't run away. Somebody told me this a long time, but you can't run away from your skin color.
Right.
So I am a Black man. So, you know, ideally, you know, everything that I do is representative of my community.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, you know, opportunities are for everyone. And I don't really differentiate between skin tone or color, creed, race, culture. It's more so a status as a young man. You know,
where I feel
my skill sets, talents, or whatever knowledge I've gathered in time is I'm able to share.
Very nice. So yeah. I guess in saying that, I guess one of my questions was if you feel that Black communities should get any extra attention or support based on their race or any racial community, but I guess you're saying no, not really. It's kind of.
I struggle with that from the standpoint that I think that, yeah, the Black community probably should get focus, but I think it should be focused for the positives. I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that, you know, a young Black male can mentor in his community and do a positive job or be a role model to their kids or their brothers or other young people in their community. I don't see it as a race thing, but I also do see that in mass media, the role of a Black mentor is not something that is, I guess, celebrated.
Okay.
And as much so, and with that, it leads to a lot of negative stereotypes, and it leads to, again, a stigma that a lot of young Black males coming up are sort of forced to repeat mistakes because the image of a strong role model is not always prevalent.
Okay.
In mass media.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's where Black History Month can play a part.
And that's where it plays a part, definitely in that month. And, you know, like, it's so cliche to say, but, you know, it should be all year long.
yes, no, it's true. And I guess what I learned when I was younger, key players in Black History Month, or people that are, I guess, stand out as, or maybe more popular than others in Black History Month, but maybe even, like, moving that up a bit, because that was maybe during the 1950s. And in terms of role models, it might be nice to have someone a bit closer to the younger generation now.
Most definitely,
yeah. Yes. So I guess that's where, like you said, Boys and Girls Clubs of Canada comes in handy. And
yeah, I think there's a lot, and I think that's where it gets into the messaging again, right? Where, you know, a lot of, you know, every time Black History Month rolls around, you know, and as the years move on, we keep rolling the clock back 40 years. 50 years.
Yeah.
All of our, like, just like you said, all of our role models are there. But I'm sure along the way somebody's sort of taken to the same mantra of those role models and have done similar type things. It's just a matter of being able to tell the stories, the work that you're doing right now, telling the stories of individuals and being able to share that.
That's true. You'll be you'll be one of the next mentors or leaders in the Black History Month kind of promo.
Well, the both of us.
Yes, sure, thanks. Is there a focus on like Black people, Black community in your work?
Yeah, well, the station that I work at now, I mean, you know this well, but
yes.
we play a unique role in that we've led North America in Afro-Caribbean content for Fifi Shims for over 20 years, and I think the station's commitment to the community that surrounds it, I think our ability to stay true to that identified community, Afro-Caribbean culture, is like it's tremendous. So it kind of forces you in a way, or brings to the forefront that there's a lot of work to be done in that community, and everything that we do, whether it's focused on that community or that community just benefits from the programming from an awareness standpoint, it's throughout everything we do.
Do you have any future ideal status or society or system for Black people? Do you see something that kind of would separate them, or you're hoping for like Black people, although it's kind of hard to define that?
I don't have an end game for I guess the Black community in my vision. I would just hope that from a selfish standpoint, you'd hope that the community sort of shakes stigmas that are out there. I think that would be like a goal of sorts, that you're able to shake those stigmas. But I also believe that in shaking those stigmas, it requires sustainable, consistent effort from a large swath of that community. So it's not incumbent on, you know, one or two standout Black males or females to make that happen.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be a collective raising of the bar across the board.
And I guess focusing on mentors and empowerment and youth even can kind of get that going.
And I think the most important one is like the work that you're doing now is like just sharing that information is the storytelling.
Yes.
So that young people know that, hey, that, you know, it's an option. It's not like it's a real, like you would say, destination point.
Okay. Yeah.
Or end game. Yeah.
Thanks. Is there anything that you'd like to share either as a message for any community out there or any kind of piece of information that you'd like to share?
I would say like just with any month, I guess, it's a mantra that we've taken here at our station at CHRY is, you know, whatever you do, however you do it, make sure in the back of your mind, you're working to make the group that you represent and the communities that you serve proud.
Thank you so much, Randy, for taking time out of your busy, busy day to speak with us about your thoughts and feelings on Black History Month and Black people, and for sharing, I think, such great positive information on mentorship and on visions for the future of all our communities. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Norman Otis Richmond, a Toronto-based journalist, is one of the main advocates in Canada for the renaming of Black History Month as African Liberation Month. He is the longtime producer and host of the radio programs Saturday Morning Live, Diasporic Music, and From a Different Perspective. His words have been heard through the studios of CIUT, CHIN, CFNY, CBC, and CKLN, and read on countless newspapers and blogs. In 1992, Otis was the recipient of the Toronto Arts Award and dedicated it to Mumia Abu-Jamal, Assata Shakur, and Geronimo Pratt, the African National Congress of South Africa, Fidel Castro, and the people of Cuba.
This PSA was brought to you in support of Black History Month on CITR 101.9 FM.
With me on the line, I have brother Kofi Sankofa out of Toronto. Kofi has over a decade of experience. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm sure you have a lot more experience as a community worker, a poet, an educator, an activist. Sankofa can be heard on the radio at CHRY 105.5 FM in Toronto. That's based out of York University. And he is on every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. Kabandwa. He's got numerous albums out. I believe he put out one recently within the past couple of years, so spoken word poetry. Kofi Sankofa, thank you for joining us. I want you to fill in any of the details I may have missed, if you can tell listeners a little bit about yourself as well.
Yes. You know what? I would probably say in the late 90s, I had the pleasure to watch a documentary called Sankofa. And while I was doing community work before that, I think the next level of community work changed since watching the movie Sankofa. And that movie kind of inspired me to go home to Africa to change my name to Kofi Abuaji Kofi Sankofa. Went to a home village in Lata to change my name. And every time somebody says Sankofa now, it directs me to the work of Sankofa, which is go back to go forward, you know, go back and see what we did right so we can correct what we need to do in the future. So that's just it, you know. The name Sankofa is an instruction, and it tells me what I must still do for the next 7 generations for African people and humanity. So
in your journey to go back and in order to go forward and instruct, what do you encounter as your some of your biggest challenges to date?
I think in that journey, you know, is when you're on the street and you're working within your communities and we see the level of ignorance. That's the most worrisome thing, because we see young people get pushed out of schools, ended up in jails, and people think that if you lock them up, that's going to solve the issue, when we're saying we need young people to get knowledge of self. Knowledge of self, and people who know themselves will not do the things that they do to themselves right now. So that's the biggest frustration, just the older people not realizing the work that we must do. They keep blaming the youth. Like Peter Tosh says, you can't blame the youth. You know, we can't blame the youth because the youth didn't grow themselves up. So we just need to just get more knowledge of self, you know. That's the main thing.
So do you have any particular goals that in mind when you're out there doing your work?
I really want total liberation in my lifetime, and if I don't get it in my lifetime, then at least for the next 100 or 200 years, to get complete liberation. And basically what complete liberation looks like, it's when we return back to ourselves, our natural selves. African people are denatured. We have lost our sense of who we are as a people. We depend on oppressors to educate us. We depend on oppressors to provide security for us. We depend on the oppressor to do everything that we as men and women should do for us. And so I want to be liberated, in, as the rest of them would say, in Balan.
You mentioned liberation, and when I think of that, I think of struggle as well, an ongoing struggle. And just to bring it back, right now we're in February at the moment, and this is Black History Month, and for me that doesn't really have the word struggle in it, doesn't bring out the struggle necessarily. We're celebrating, we're recognizing, but at the same time there might be a different way we can approach the month. I've heard African liberation being used elsewhere, maybe not so much out here. And I wanted to maybe get your opinion on that and what you think.
You know, and most of the time when I speak, I don't speak from an opinion point of view, because I'm in work with ancestors and the struggle. So once you begin to do the work and in your culture, you know, they have a thing you call in ancient Africa the third eye. And once your third eye, the insight opens, you're no longer speaking of just opinion, but you're speaking of what your ancestors is actually speaking through you to say. And so when I look at today, do you know that every year for the past years we learn Black history, African people has learned less about themselves? I think, you know, the oppressor always take things, you know, like Black history and turn it into a song and dance, a pony show type of thing, where people come together for February, they do their thing and they go back. The gentleman, Mr. Carter G. Woodson, that African person who has a book called The Miseducation of the Negro, when he envisioned the idea, he saw it as a moment. He started out with a week, but he saw it as a way of reflecting on the things we have done for the year, not necessarily just calling out names, because in this society we live in a place of capitalism, white supremacy, and patriarchy, what we do is we call out names. We call names. We talk about Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and then we then have a party, and we have a little bit of gathering, and we move on. This thing called African Liberation Month, we call it, and we say liberation because we have not been liberated yet from the enslavement, colonization. Things have just changed, Robin. Things changed, but it didn't become different. So, you know, when we had the enslavement piece, when people went to Africa and kidnapped Africans, we called it slavery, and we said, you know, Africans were enslaved. And then the oppressor said, well, you're free. And we had a party. We celebrated this freedom from slavery. And then in 1885 in Berlin, the powers that be, the European powers again met and decided to colonize Africa, to re-enslave Africa. And when that was done, they said, you're independent. And we had another party in the 60s, and then back and call it neo-colonialization. And today they're calling it globalization. So for us, we think slavery never ended. The words have changed. The UN, like, for instance, the United Nations, they pretend like they are some type of organization that protects the world. But we know that there's six Security Council member on there that decide that they can override other countries. So how can you have a United Nation when only six countries have the power to veto or not? So when we look at globally, the world globally, we're saying Black history will be co-opted. Now it's been co-opted, and they turn it into a party, a little song and dance. So that's what they have done to it. So we don't just deal with February. We deal with African liberation every day. Because one of my elders, Neely Fuller Jr., stated this. This is his quote, and I don't want to misquote him, but I want to quote him properly. He said that if we, the people, don't understand white supremacy, racism, how its function, how it works, everything we think we understand will only confuse us. So as a child, you learn to every African family and every African family and every colored family and every people of different nations, they should teach their children what is white supremacy. Because until we defeat white supremacy, none of us can live free to be our best. Because white supremacy is like you're at war. You're struggling every day. I work for the school board. I work in radio. But every time I go somewhere, I'm not just fighting European supremacy. I'm also fighting the victims of European supremacy. Because what happens is, when I speak, the first people that come to the defense of white supremacy is people that look like me, you, and other cultures in this society that come and defend European supremacy. We don't call it white supremacy. We're changing the name as we realize that it is not white supremacy. No color people are white. But I think the problem with that supremacy is about European being inferior and not loving themselves enough so they don't have to do the things they have done globally. We see things done globally, and I study it globally. You know, people tend to see the you have the racial profiling. and Robin, people will see racial profiling as, oh yeah, you know, the police. But for us who study this, it's part of a military system of white supremacy. The soldiers, the army, the navy, all of that is part of that capitalism to subjugate the people of the world, the majority of the people, because we're not minorities, by the way, but the majorities. That's why these things are. And so we have to look at things from a global perspective, not just, you know, oh, it's just one event. The police is racist. It's deeper than that.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the need to learn. And I find a lot of what you're talking about can be very subtle enough that people don't see it, they don't hear it, but it's been said every day, all day. What comes to mind is something that you shared with me earlier, and I found a video clip of what happened in England during the 200 years. At the I believe it was an abbey or a church where the queen and the prime minister was there, and it on the surface level, it appears, oh, okay, there's some sort of apology or some kind of amends that has been made. Yeah. It's a gesture. But then you look at it, and if you can take off the blinders, so to speak, and you can look at it for what it is, there's new, kind of like a new speak, a new lingo going on. One side of the mouth can be an apology, whereas coming out of the other side, it's still the same story that's happening globally, as you mentioned. And I think the struggle... is still there. The issues are still there.
Did you know, though, that that thing in England was worse than that? That sort of apology. Did you know that they actually had TV shows going around England teaching young people? They had like a show where they would ask the kids, you know, the kids said, so they say, who's the bad person? And they had a white person, a black person. And the kid said, oh, I think the white person would be the enslaver. And the person said, no. That's the chief. That's the chief who sold the Africans into slavery. And so those were the stuff they were doing actually on the TV and in schools in England. So it wasn't just, they were like, we call them revisionists. They are trying to change history to satisfy their lies. And it was ironic that our good brother Toyin Akbetu, when they asked us everybody to kneel down and ask for forgiveness, he couldn't bring himself to that. So he got up and he said, not in the name of the ancestors. You know, not in the name of the ancestors. It is you that did this. You know, they will tell you that African people sold African people. Well, let them bring an African who they said sold another African. They can't provide the evidence. But they will tell you this, and even if people collaborated, Africa never had a system of selling people. That was Europe. The Europeans did this, and they're then trying to take the blame off themselves to say, oh, no, it's African people that did this, but no. And so when we teach history, we must speak the truth to power, because sometimes, you know, it sometimes hurts, and people might be hearing this now, and they probably will be getting upset. But rather than get upset, do some research. Look things up. Ask yourself why this society we live in is not, after we have so much to feed everyone, why are we still having poverty in British Columbia, in Vancouver Island? Why is it, you know, people are being oppressed in a place of plenty like Canada? So we got to ask, and capitalism and all of this plays in itself to protect the rich and then subjugate people who they call poor.
Mm. And to bring it back, I guess, and, to locally, especially Toronto, we're talking about profiling. Police do this all the time, and the work being done, and from back in the day as well, and over time. Names come to mind like Dudley Laws, who recently passed away, but really outspoken critics, people who have been fighting for us to make positive change and to bring awareness around. Where do you see that as what is the status now as compared to how the struggle was maybe 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and what else needs to be? I mean, you've touched already what needs to be done, but in terms of actually on the ground, what might be happening in Toronto, what what still needs to happen and any specifics that are going on right now that we can point to or look to speak with people or to gain more knowledge.
Yeah, I see that today we are actually going backwards. Every generation that comes forth in Toronto and the world for African people is going 50 years back. You know, in the 50s, in the 60s, we were aware of who the oppressor was. You know, Dudley Laws knew exactly what he had to do. Not that he get a lot of support from the community, because a lot of them saw him as just somebody shouting on the street, shouting as good law, police, abiding police officers. But Dudley Laws knew that what oppression was 50 years ago, 100 years ago. We knew because we were being beaten. The problem in today's society is that technology, they have given us, some of us got political jobs. Some of us have a suit. Some of us have is a CEO now, chief executive officer. We are vice president at banks. A lot of us are living like a fat cat, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we think we have arrived. And there lies our dilemma. Because the fact that we think we've arrived, a lot of us is now at home, you know, driving our Cadillac and sitting up watching the 70-inch screen TV while the youths are being shot down on the streets in Toronto. There's a group in Toronto we call Tavis. And Tavis is an organization that the police just got some big money from the province, the provincial government, right? And basically they'd come have barbecue in the neighborhood in the daytime. And then at night, they kick on your door 4 in the morning, lock up 70 people, have a big news conference, right? And then, in the next day, they let out 50 of those people because they were not locked up for any particular reason. But then they put in the media that they got 10 guns and all of that stuff. Because the police and the military apparatus in this society, in Toronto and all over, is here to make crime happen. You know, I was talking to somebody, Robin, today, and I said to them, what would happen to the police if we had no murder in Toronto? Do you imagine when young people wake up and we start educating them, because we have to educate our young people, we have to educate them on the streets. But what happens when they wake up and they become educated, right? And they then no longer want to participate in a place where poverty, ignorance cause young people to come crime. Because it is those two things, ignorance and poverty, you know, that cause these things. So my main goal right now is not necessarily to march with the police, Robin. I don't want to go downtown and yell at police. Mm. I want to go and educate young people how to take the power back to themselves, how to defeat this Eurocentric society. And the only way to defeat them is to know thyself. You know, I don't want to sound like way out, but if you know yourself, Robin, you don't destroy yourself. Mm. If you know your African history and culture, you don't destroy yourself. And so our goal for the next little while, because I run cultural classes at Knowledge Bookstore, I support cultural classes at ACHA, the African Canadian Heritage Association, ACCLF, the African Canadian Children Literary Festival. So we're doing a lot of work on the ground. As a matter of fact, I just want to let your listeners know that we have decided, after observing Haiti, the great liberation place in country the people call Haiti. I was down there a few years before the earthquake. I was helping some schools in Cité Soleil and doing some work down there. And after several years, I was sitting at home, and like my spirit just says, you know what, Brother Sankofa, you go now and build an African-centered school in Leicester. So my next goal is to build a school in Leicester, Haiti, where when we build a school, we could build on in the school. We could build the revolution in the school. We could build, you know, all the great African history, Jean-Jacques Dessalines in the school, Makandal. And so that's something that we're planning to do right now. So 2013, I will, if I have to work night and day to build this out of my own pocket, we'll do it. Because these things we have to do. I can't beg anybody to do it. I can't argue with the people who made the promises to the Asian people and didn't even deliver the money. You know that half of that money has still not gone to the people. Half of that money is still somewhere in promised land.
and you've been answering a lot of my questions before I even had a chance to ask them. That's what I was going to say next, is that you've been doing not only work locally, but you also have a big focus in Haiti. And I was going to ask you why you're doing that, and you know what you face, what you face doing that in terms of fundraising and travel, because I've heard bits of about your experiences even just on the plane trips. But also, for most people out there who might think, oh, it's just easier to send money to an NGO, one of the numerous NGOs who are doing work, what is the difference between what their idea of reconstruction is and versus what you're doing, which is so selfless and such a huge task as well?
Yeah, well, the first thing is I make sure I don't deal with NGOs. I don't use the term, and I don't want nothing to do with the term, because that term is loaded. And most of those NGOs are government spy agencies. CISA and all of those organizations, many of them from Canada and the U.S., they go down there in Haiti and Africa to destabilize the government. A lot of them are paid money, you know, when a lot of the monies are given. A lot of these agencies from Canada and the U.S., you know, they get paid big money to do surveys and